What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
But this is the fundamentalist problem, or one of them, is they tend to bundle everything together so tightly that if you lose one aspect of your theology, it all goes down together. It all collapses together. It doesn't need to be that way. You can totally rethink your, you know, atonement theories or your ideas about afterlife judgment or your eschatology without necessarily having to destroy Christian faith. And the other thing is, none of this is particularly new. We're in a time when there seems to be an acceleration in the numbers of people that are having to rethink faith. I get all that. And that there is something peculiar about modernity, and Nietzsche saw that and foretold it and all. But the issues that are driving Christians to go through, quote, deconstruction, and maybe their faith doesn't survive it, they're not new issues. They're not new questions. These things, the church has been addressing most of them anyway for a very long time. We don't know. I think the
truth is. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson. If you are new here, thank you for joining in on the conversation. If you've been around for a while, then thank you for continuing to support this work. Few things before we get to this week's episode. The one-stop shop for the podcast is www.thedeconstructionists.com. There you can stream our entire back catalog of episodes, link to us on social media, read our blog, and join our Patreon family, where we have all sorts of packages like our popular book club. The theme music this week is provided by our friend Clay under his moniker Forest Clay. He just released an amazing all-new EP all about deconstruction called the Recover EP, and that is available anywhere you find your music. This week's guest is a returning guest, an amazing human being all around who also has great taste in music. It's Brian Zond. We talk all about the state of the world and his amazing new book. It's called When Everything's on Fire, Faith Forged from the Ashes. So go grab a copy anywhere books are sold, and without further ado, I bring you Brian freaking Zond. All right. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Zond, thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's always a privilege.
Absolutely. I was just looking, and I think it's been since 2017, since last we had you on. So you've got a new book. When Everything's on Fire, which could not be more appropriate of a title in terms of all the copious amounts of things that seem to be kind of, you know, up in flames, as it were. So what inspired you to write this book in particular?
Well, my wife and I have we've become pilgrims in our latter years now. we like going on long walks. I'm just back from Scotland just last week, and we walked 70 miles on St. Cuthbert's Way. But our favorite is the 500-mile pilgrimage across northern Spain. Actually, it begins in the French Pyrenees and then goes all the way to Santiago de Compostela, Spain, 500 miles. We've done it three times. The last time we did that was in the fall of 2019, 2 years ago. And of course, as you might imagine, this kind of life where you just, you know, it becomes very simple. You just carry all of your possessions that you need for 500 miles on your back, and you walk day after day. It gives you a lot of time to think. You can really sort of slide into a very contemplative state. And so I was thinking about, you know, the age in which we live is not a particular friend to maintaining Christian faith. And it's just hard. And things happen. And people lose their faith. And it's an increasingly common story. And then, of course, one right-wing Christian reaction is just to get mad about it or cast it in terms of culture war, which is completely doesn't help. And so I understood that, you know, something has happened in modernity that has presented a particular challenge to Christian faith. And I was thinking about this, and, you know, I've been a pastor of one church for 40 years. This first Sunday in November, it'll be 40 years. And I was thinking, well, if I had the opportunity to talk to people who are going through what is sometimes called deconstruction, I'm sure we'll get into that term, what would I say? And so I was just thinking about that. And we were, I don't know, about halfway through the Camino, we came to this, what town was it? I don't know if I can remember. I forgot. One of the Spanish towns there sits up on a hilltop, very lovely setting. And I sat there after our 15-mile walk or whatever that day, and I outlined the 11 chapters of this book, and it stayed pretty close to it. And I gave it the title, When Everything's on Fire. That was in 2019, and then in early 2020, well, no, Everything's on Fire. But anyway, so that's where it comes from. It comes from, I guess, a pastor's heart who's a little bit conversant in philosophy, who wants to try to help people navigate the world that we often refer to as deconstruction in a way that hopefully reevaluates and reinvigorates faith and rather than destroy faith.
Yeah, and I loved your chapter, by the way, on deconstructing deconstruction, and obviously that's the name of my podcast, and it's interesting, and I. The reason I love this chapter so much is...
This is the one podcast that I must be on for this book.
Right. You know, it's funny, though, because I look back and this chapter speaks exactly to kind of the way I've been feeling over the past, like, probably a couple years now. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine recently about the fact that when Adam and I first started this podcast almost 6 years ago now, the term deconstruction in the way that it kind of been co-opted from its original, you know, definition as coined by Jacques Derrida, was not as much in the lexicon probably as it is now. And right. And now there's just a sea, there's a flood of podcasts who are kind of doing this sort of, for lack of a better word, like progressive Christian kind of formula, but using it in a way that it was never intended on our part anyway. I think ours would fall in line with exactly what you're saying in this chapter.
And there is a reason why the term has gained currency, right? I mean, somehow that word is resonating with people. It's not my favorite way to describe it. I think there maybe is some inherent danger sometimes because deconstruction can sound too much like destruction.
Yes.
And we can talk about all that. But the fact remains that it has become a popular term for some reason. I mean, people do resonate with it, that they enter a period where their faith, as they have received it, known it, practiced it, maybe from childhood, is just no longer tenable. And something has to happen. Either it's a vigorous reevaluation that has an end of sorts and brings them into a different place, hopefully a better place, where Christian faith is again possible. But that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes you start and if deconstruction is the end in itself, well, you can't deconstruct forever and have anything left. And
right,
that's when
right.
I feel like it's too much of a cavalier approach where the only goal is to tear everything down. And I do see some of that. And I view that as very rude, if nothing else. I mean, if you want to tear, if you want to destroy your own faith, it's your faith. Okay. I would like to talk with you first, but okay. But to deliberately set out to try to kind of demolish people's faith, it reminds me of the philosophy professors that I saw in college way back when, who just got some sort of perverse glee out of demolishing the Christian faith of, you know, freshmen. And I just thought, well, you know, come on. I just felt like that was not a very noble endeavor.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny, we were having this very same conversation years and years ago. We were actually sitting down with Rob Bell, mm-hmm. and we're saying that, you know, we have this love-hate relationship with the term itself, and obviously we kind of used it as our podcast name because we knew it was kind of provocative, and for a large number of people, it kind of gave a name to kind of a spiritual journey that they were on. And so in that sense, it was kind of a useful thing because they could put a name to the experience that they were going through. But we always had an issue with it because we never met destruction, you know? And so he was the one that suggested, we'll just put brackets around the D and the E. So then you have D and construction. Mm-hmm. We thought, oh, that's great. So that's why we did that. But I see a lot of that recently, and you talk about this in that chapter. You talk about the fact that for a lot of people who are coming out of more of a conservative fundamentalist background, they want to burn the whole thing down and throw the baby out with the bathwater.
There's a backstory there somewhere. Usually, sure. There's pain. They've suffered something, and so I want to be tender with those people. I want to be careful because usually there's a story, and you know, as the saying goes, hurt people hurt people. And so I understand that. And there are plenty of stories to be told. I get that. But there is also that which is true, good, and beautiful about this received faith that is Christianity.
And I think what's so important that you say in the book also, and this is one of the things that we've tried to make clear in our podcast in terms of the way that we mean deconstruction, is that there's a difference between deconstruction or destruction rather, and restoration. It's very easy to knock a building down. It's much more difficult and takes a lot more time and skill to restore it and renovate it.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, I use the analogy of imagining that a precious icon of Christ is found in some forgotten corner in a monastery in Russia somewhere. And it's valuable, it's precious, it has the image of Christ, it's a great work of art, but over the centuries, grime and soot and ash and dirt and whatever have created this dark patina upon the icon, and the image of Christ is almost obliterated. Well, you don't throw it away. You say, okay, let's see if we can restore it. And so you bring in the restoration artist. And whatever equipment, not that I know anything about this, but whatever equipment the restoration artist employs, I'm pretty sure that in her bag of tricks, you don't find dynamite and sledgehammers. And so, you know, it's a precious thing. And so we want to be careful with it. And so I think the end is not to, you know, blow up the Buddhas like the Taliban does, but to see what can be recovered. And I understand that for some people, it's an open question as they begin to enter this phase. They don't know. But I think most of us could agree that faith is precious enough that we should at least hold out the hope that we can not destroy, but restore. You know, I mean, I have my own story with that. I mean, I'm not a stranger to this. I mean, I went through a very radical, very public theological transition that began in 2004. I mean, while pastoring a church, so that makes it interesting. You know, it's one thing, you know, to reevaluate your faith and all of that, you know, as it were, a private citizen. It's another thing to do it very publicly as a pastor of a relatively large church. And that's, you know, that's my book, Water to Wine, which is kind of a memoir of sorts. But that was I never thought of it as deconstruction. I mean, that was a little bit before that term was being used to describe what we're talking about. I'd read enough Derrida. I knew that term. I understood theologically, philosophically. But I never thought of it like that. I was always able to make a distinction. This is just my story. I'm not saying everybody's this way, but my fascination with Jesus never abated, and it was really never in question. I just reached the point where I thought Jesus deserves a better Christianity than what it is I'm seeing here in America in my context. And I went on a search for it. We can just roll with this if you want, John. In the book, I like the water to wine metaphor. I like that a lot. But another metaphor that I found helpful is I talk about your theological house. You know, now this is the metaphor. I mean, we all have our theological house. This is how we think about God and what we say about God and all that sort of stuff. And our theological house comes to be however it does. I mean, we inherit it. We just pick things up here and there. And over time, if we think very much about God, there we have it, our theological house. And I began to realize that I was embarrassed by my theological house. I wasn't ashamed of Jesus. I knew Jesus was just infinitely attractive. I mean, this is the thing, John. I mean, nobody really hates Jesus, right?
That's true.
Nietzsche at times, if you attack Jesus of Nazareth, it just is it never comes off. It just doesn't look good. People don't buy it. Nietzsche tried it, but he couldn't sustain it because he couldn't convince himself. He ends up being kind of a grudging admirer of Jesus. So I wasn't ashamed of Jesus, but I was embarrassed by the house I was living in, the theological house. So I didn't want to have company over, you know. And so, you know, what happens? Well, then you decide, you know what? I'm going to remodel my house. Yeah, have you ever tried to remodel a house while living in it? It's messy. It's inconvenient. It's difficult. It will cost more than you think and take longer than you think. But that's what I did. But your theological house isn't one room. It's not a one room bungalow. It's just kind of like this sprawling old English manor house, you know, or something. And I had rooms that we added a coat of paint, you know. There wasn't a lot of changing. I think my Christology is deeper and richer today, but I don't think it was significantly altered in any way. On the other hand, there was a whole wing called eschatology. that wing actually did go through some real serious deconstruction. I mean, we brought in the sledgehammers, took it down, not just down to the studs. I think we took it down to the foundation. Because, you know, I had just inherited that, you know what I'm talking about, that late great planet Earth left behind dispensationalism. I want to defend myself here a little bit. I never liked the left behind stuff. When it was all the rage, I thought, okay, I'm gonna read these because, you know, the whole world is reading these. And I got halfway through the first chapter and couldn't read it. I was so offended, not by the theology, I probably believed a lot of the theology, but by just how terrible the prose was. I just thought, I'm better than this. I'm not gonna read this level of literature. So some things, but this is the fundamentalist problem, or one of them, is they tend to bundle everything together so tightly that if you lose one aspect of your theology, it all goes down together. It all collapses together. It doesn't need to be that way. You can totally rethink your, you know, atonement theories or your ideas about afterlife judgment or your eschatology without necessarily having to destroy Christian faith. And the other thing is, none of this is particularly new. We're in a time when there seems to be an acceleration in the numbers of people that are having to rethink faith. I get all that. And that there is something peculiar about modernity, and Nietzsche saw that and foretold it and all. But the issues that are driving Christians to go through, quote, deconstruction, and maybe their faith doesn't survive it, they're not new issues. They're not new questions. These things, the church has been addressing most of them anyway for a very long time. It tends to be, though, the people that come from some kind of evangelical or quasi-fundamentalist background where, in a weird sort of way, they continue to be fundamentalist. you know how a fundamentalist believes that the only legitimate version of Christianity is fundamentalism, and then when that doesn't work for them, they make another fundamentalist move and say, well, then I just have to reject all of Christianity. They never pause and go, right. Wait a minute, there's Eastern Orthodoxy, there's Catholicism, there's mainline Protestantism, there's all kinds of options out there. All right, well, I'm just going on and on. So you're going to have to jump in here, John, and get us back on track.
No, that's good. I think it's interesting because a lot of my friends who kind of came out of that more of a fundamentalist movement, they kind of argue that they take the Bible more seriously than the rest of us, and yet kind of ignore hundreds and hundreds of years of, you know, biblical history and Christian history that came before the 20th century. And it's like, you know, once you start digging in, and at this point, in my opinion, we have no excuse to be uneducated at this point in the age of the internet and information that's so easily accessible. There is a lot of information out there that you can get at a moment's notice, and you tend to find out that a lot of these positions weren't the positions held by Christians.
Yeah, fundamentalism is a modern phenomenon. I mean, I'm talking about Christian fundamentalism. Is a wrong-headed reaction to the Enlightenment and the empiricism that's a part of that. It's trying to use the tool. It's a fool's attempt at using the tools of empiricism to try to prove that would be the word. Try to prove Christianity, which is. No, that isn't how this is done, and that's a gambit that you're going to lose. It's actually, once you accept, and I don't want people to misunderstand me. I'm all for science. I don't know of a single major peer-reviewed scientific theory that is any threat to my faith. None. I don't know of one. And I'm all for advancement in technology. I just got back from the dentist. I'm glad I wasn't going to a medieval dentist.
It's true.
But we have Descartes approaching epistemology through doubt. He says, all right, well, I'm going to doubt everything that can be doubted and find epistemological bedrock. That was his project. And he's doubting everything. And then he realizes, oh, but in the process of doubting, I'm thinking. And there you go, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. And therefore, the individual, that's part of the problem, the individual thinking self becomes the sole arbiter of what is true. And what that does is it makes this implicit claim, and this becomes pretty clear in the Enlightenment, that all that can be known about being is going to be ascertained through the five physical senses. Well, I'm all for knowing all that can be known through the five physical senses. I'm just saying that when empiricism has done all it can do and has said all it can say, there's still more to be said. That there is a world that is not accessible through those means. You call it heaven, you call it spirit, call it whatever you want to call it, call it the realm of the soul, but it's where things like love exist. And see, this is where Nietzsche and Marx and Freud, the masters of suspicion, they're all suspicious, especially of love. They believe that love can't be what it really claims to be. You know, Freud's going to say, no, it's mostly just about sex. And Marx says, no, it's mostly about money. And Nietzsche's going to say, no, it's all about power. It's the idea of loving your neighbor. That's a slave morality. That's the way that the weak control the strong. And they're suspicious that love exists. I think most everyone, no matter what you think about God, you believe that love is real, I think. And that it isn't, yes, our chemicals and hormones, and, oh, sure, that's all a part of it because we are an embodied being. But is that all? Are we just a machine? Or is there, well, if God is the one thing God is not, is an object somewhere in the universe. And so you're not going to find him in the telescope or the microscope. You're going to have to encounter him through, to use common language, through the heart. But see, in a post-Enlightenment world here in late modernity, we've been shamed by that. We've been said, oh, you know, the heart, as if it's all just subjective emotionalism. Blaise Pascal, the contemporary and intellectual equal of Descartes, and by the way, Descartes was a believing Catholic. He was trying, as it wasn't his main thing, but he was in part trying to prove the existence of God, which, again, that's not how we go about it. But Blaise Pascal gives us this beautiful axiom, the heart has its reasons, of which reason knows nothing. I think most people resonate with that. The heart has its reasons, of which reason knows nothing. And so if we're going to have a direct encounter with God, this is what we mean by mysticism. Mysticism doesn't mean, you know, whatever, witchcraft or New Age. I mean, it's simply, by Christian mysticism, we simply mean the experience of a direct encounter with the divine. And, of course, the New Testament bears, well, the whole Bible, the Old Testament, New Testament, bear witness not only to the possibility of such things, but hint at the normalcy of such things. But this in fact, is the normal Jewish Christian life, is to be able to have some kind of subjective encounter with God. And but we've turned away from that in modernity, and it was Karl Rahner, great Catholic German theologian, who in 1971 said, the Christian of the future will be a mystic or nothing at all.
Yes.
I thought that's very prescient. That's, you know, I would put the tag prophetic on that one. And I believe that's true, that the project of sustaining Christian faith through the apologetics that are of the Josh McDowell or Ken Ham, that's really a bad one. I think those days are over. They should never have arrived. They should never have come, but they did. People that are going to continue with Christian faith into the future, I think for the most part, are going to be people who say, I do experience God in some way or another. And so we've Descartes kicked us up inside our heads. We're up in our head all the time. And I'm saying that, fine, if you're trying to invent microprocessors or explore black holes or whatever else you're doing, I'm all for that. I mean, Blaise Pascal was not against thought. I mean, he's one of the greatest mathematicians in history. He was a rational thinker. But Blaise Pascal understood that that's not the entire, that there are ways of knowing that are not rational, that are maybe spiritual. He uses the word heart. The heart has its reasons, of which reason knows nothing. And so I think Christians need to climb down out of the attic of their head up there with a bunch of old dusty National Geographic magazines and come down into the living room, the hearth room, where there's a fireplace, and learn once again to encounter God. So I think, like a lot of the medieval mystics, like John the Cross and Teresa of Avila and Julian of Norwich, or more modern, like Thomas Merton, they have a lot to say to this. And I think those are the people we should be paying attention to right now.
Absolutely. And I think I think there's no accident that mystics and mysticism has seen a rise in recent times. And kind of this, because I think, in large part, a lot of the kind of Western Christian sort of interpretation of Christianity seems so heavily bound to the Bible being the be-all, end-all, and kind of does away with the kind of personal experience. And so I think there's no question. I don't think there's any accident that people like Richard Rohr, you know, a 70-something-year-old Catholic monk who's insanely popular with younger folks exactly. Right now. I don't think that's an accident.
No, it's not an accident. And we've had I could be harsh. I don't want to be too hard, but certain expressions of Christianity in the American context feel very commercial. I've been a pastor for, it's coming up on 40 years, since I was 22. I'm 62, So it's a life's work. And I've been around that world and I know it pretty well. I'm going to be careful what I say here, but most of the pastors I've known over the years, if they weren't pastors, they would be businessmen. And this is a new phenomenon. I've always kind of liked philosophy and then got pulled away from it because I didn't think that's what I was supposed to do as a pastor. And then when I had this transition or whatever you call it, deconstruction, although that's not the word I use, beginning in 2004, I returned to philosophy and began to read it a lot. And you'd be surprised how many pastors thought that was the most absurd. They thought it was like bizarre to them. And yet that would have been the norm for whatever, forever, up until, you know, maybe 100 years ago. In America. I mean, you expected pastors to know philosophy and to be maybe more in tune with, first of all, you expected them to know the church fathers, you expected them to know church history, you expected them to know the general contours of historical Christian theology. Many American pastors, most American pastors in the evangelical, especially the charismatic, that was my world, charismatic context, they don't know any of that. Right. What they do know is if the mega church pastor in your town wasn't a mega church pastor, he'd probably have the largest car dealership in town. And that's right. That's not, I mean, they don't mean that as ugly as it sounds. I'm just saying it's been very commercial. Eugene Peterson talked about, you know, the pastor has become a shopkeeper in America. And I think people, I mean, a certain kind, a more thoughtful person sees through that. And they say, well, if I'm going to be interested in religion or spirituality or church in any way, I really kind of want to, I want a mystic. I want someone who maybe, to use the phrase of Walter Brueggemann, can bring a word from elsewhere. Now, the American church growth model has been, I don't think anybody, people aren't sitting around and consciously thinking this, but here's what they really do, is they identify the assumed cultural values of America and then offer a little Jesus spin of it, a Jesus version of it. And so that it's never really pushing against the grain. And that works. I mean, there's enough people that still think, I got to hold on to Jesus, and I also want to, you know, have money and raise good kids and have a victorious life, you know, that kind of language. And so if there's a Jesus way of doing this, and that's what I want. But I think that's coming to an end, and more people are saying, if church, Christianity, religion has any value, I think it's going to be very different than a trip to the mall. It's going to be, there's going to have to be some sage-like quality to it, something that speaks of wisdom from a different time or from a different place. And so, Of course, of late, the evangelical church in America has not just been commercial, it's now become intensely political, and they're just publicly committing suicide. I mean, there's an energy in it right now. It's negative, but there is energy, but they will not successfully pass on that kind of Christianity to a younger generation. They are just, you know, it's the saddest thing in the world to see. This is more like my book, Postcards from Babylon, we're supposed to be talking about when everything's on fire, but it kind of all goes together.
Right.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
No, I hope you're right that version of Christianity does not pass on to the next generation. And I think you are right. I think this new generation of what millennials or whatever came after that, I think they are intensely smart. And I think you're right. I think they do see things that are authentic and inauthentic, and they can see the difference and they know the difference. And we don't often give them that type of credit, I think. But one of the things I want to get your take on, because you mentioned this, and I love this line in your book, is you talk about this popular aphorism, and we hear this all over the place all the time. There's a popular Christian radio station around here that plays like cool rock music and everything. And I enjoy their music, but the tagline is often that, you know, this personal relationship with God. And so you talk about Christianity is not a relationship, it's a religion. And I would love for you to expand on that a little.
Yeah, we've become so sloppy in our language, and everything's mixed up. Christians do not claim that Christianity is the truth. Christians claim that Jesus is the truth. That's our claim, that we say Jesus is the truth of God, the truth of the Logos incarnate. But what happens is we have this. We have Christ. We have the Logos that becomes flesh, and the entire gospel story of incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, ascension. Out of that grows the Christian religion of faith, dogma, doctrine, theology, practice. That's the Christian religion. Somebody says, Jesus didn't come to start a religion. Of course not. He already had a religion. He was a Jew.
Right.
But the impact of the Word becoming flesh and joining humanity was such that it is inevitable that a religion is going to grow up around that. But then what happens Voltaire and his successors come along and begin to mount a relentless attack upon religion and tradition. And this is the hallmark of modernity, by the way. Modernity is a tradition of critiquing all other traditions. Modernity likes to pretend it's not a tradition. It thinks modernity is very arrogant. Modernity says, we're just the truth. We're just the truth. But their truth is to attack all other traditions. And so I don't really consider myself postmodern. I don't know what I am, or maybe I'm kind of right-wing postmodern. But but I do appreciate this from postmodernity. It punctures the pride of modernity. It is postmodernity that kind of holds up a mirror and says, you know, modernity, you're just a tradition of critiquing all other traditions, but you're still a tradition. Well, So the impulse that you see among certain Christians that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. They are not emulating Christ or apostles. They are emulating Voltaire and Nietzsche. That's really who they're emulating, whether they know it or not. And we just don't need to do that. I mean, first of all, Jesus was by any definition a deeply religious man. I mean, with religious texts, religious probably apparel, religious diet, religious calendar. Jesus was an observant Jew whose religion formed his life. So to say now what Jesus was critical of was hypocrisy. And I think that's another way that we're sloppy, that sometimes what we mean by being against religion is against hypocrisy. Well, rock on. Yeah, we want to be against hypocrisy. Let's just be careful we don't define hypocrisy too tight so that any failure to live up to your highest aspiration is hypocrisy. That's not hypocrisy. That's just failure. That's just being a sinner. That's just being human, that we have our highest aspirations and we fall short. That's not hypocrisy. We know what hypocrisy is. Hypocrisy is deliberately, knowingly pretending you're something than you really are, that it all becomes a facade, a charade. Yes, Jesus has his most vicious assault upon that kind of distortion of religion, but Jesus isn't against religion itself. You know, I tell people all the time, if you have a personal relationship with Jesus, you can thank the Christian religion for making that possible, because it's the Christian religion that maintains the message. I mean, the Jesus that you claim to have a personal relationship with, I assume that you have a Bible somewhere in that story, that you've read the gospel stories. And who do you think prints these Bibles? Who do you think translates these Bibles? This is an activity within the Christian religion. So when we recognize that Christianity is a religion, I think in some ways, if you can hear me, it takes the pressure off. Because what those that say this, what they want to say then is if you say Christianity isn't a religion, then what is it? What are you left with? And they'll give various answers, but ultimately, if you push them hard enough, they'll say it's the truth, the truth. Well, that puts a lot of pressure on. Because you're claiming that your religion is ultimate truth. Well, it doesn't take long to find flaws in that, because you'll find something where the religion itself disagrees, and so then that means, well, it's actually my little strand of Christianity that is the truth. And you see how that doesn't work. So when I say that Christianity is a religion, I'm giving it room to be wrong in certain areas, but also to be somewhat flexible and able to change over time, rooted in history, rooted in our long history, but still capable of changing. So, you know, and then often when people, another conflation they make is they conflate Christianity and the Bible all into one thing. And, well, this creates scandal, because there's a lot of examples, but the one I usually go to is, the Bible never gives a clear, unequivocal condemnation of the institution of slavery in the Old or New Testament. I mean, the New Testament, it's slaves obey your masters. It's in there four times. And so if you're being honest, you just say, okay, the Bible in its self-aware state, even in the New Testament, doesn't have a vision of the abolition of slavery. Now, I would say there are ideas that are communicated through Scripture from Christ and from Paul that eventually will cause some things to click. But so the Bible isn't Christianity. The Bible is the canonical text within the religion that we always have to be rooted in and have conversation with. But because it's not the faith itself, the religion of Christianity is growing and it changes over time, and it's capable of producing limbs and boughs of abolition. So I guess the simplest way I would protest the idea that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship, that sloppy sentiment, and it's driven by wanting to keep Voltaire and Nietzsche and their successors happy, and we don't have to do that. It is a religion. Yeah, and I am a religious man. You know, people say, well, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. We're all spiritual. Who isn't spiritual? We're all spiritual, but I'm also religious. And I mean, it's the last act of rebellion in our secular age to be religious. I mean, how else? In our libertine age, how else are you going to rebel? What can you do? Oh, man, that guy's a rebel. I think to be deliberately religious and to say it.
Yeah.
Takes. I mean, I have my Ramones shirt on here. So, I mean, it's a little bit punk rock to be religious in the age in which we live.
It is. That is true.
That's a good line. There you go. That's the line for that's the quote that you promote the podcast with. With this episode, BZ. Why did I say it? I know I was just riffing there, but to be religious in this age is a little bit punk rock or something like that. Whatever.
That's the t-shirt right there. No, it's so true. And I think, again, I think this all comes back nicely to what we were talking about previously about mysticism and the fact that mysticism does allow you that space and that room for your religion to grow and to be wrong, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. One of the sections of the book that I think is probably my favorite starts on page 44. I think people should need to go out and get the book so they know what I'm talking about. But it's a section that you called hard-won advice. And you've got this nice little breakdown of different pieces of advice. And the first thing, obviously, starting off with is don't be afraid and don't be ashamed. And it references, obviously, going through a period of doubt as something that's a natural part of the process.
Yeah, you can't be a believer without the possibility of also, or without the reality of also being a doubter. I mean, the idea that it's a fallacy to think that to believe means you don't doubt. No, we are constantly making the leap to faith. We have to do it over and over and over. But the struggle with doubt is what we do as believers. And so it's just nothing to be ashamed of or really even afraid of. I think early in the book, I quote Dostoevsky, who says, I believe in Christ not as some child. My Hosanna has passed through an enormous furnace of doubt. And I just want to tell people, I've wrestled with all, I tried, at least philosophically, to be an atheist while being a pastor. And I just couldn't do it. I honestly couldn't get there. But when you take on your doubts, when you just, you know, doubts, if you deny them, if you try to pretend they're not there, you lock them in a closet somewhere, that's where they turn into monsters. If you just bring doubt out into the open, into the daylight, and say, well, let's look at this doubt, most of them aren't that scary. Most of them are saying, well, okay, I think I can work around this or work with this or, you know, live with it if I have to. That's kind of what I think about that.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is interesting about that also is one of the things that your book kind of brought to mind for me is this idea that there's only one side of the pendulum, and you talk about this also, actually, beware the pendulum. Yeah. But you talk about the fact that, you know, there's this fallacy that there's only one of two ways, one of two paths, I guess, to go. And it's either this kind of American version of Christianity, this Western kind of fundamentalist version of Christianity, or atheism. And that's it. Those are your only two choices.
And you're still a fundamentalist when you become an atheist when you do that.
right. So it's just like an extreme
fundamentalism,
position.
You just left Christianity, but you're still a fundamentalist.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because when I talk to people, when I talk to friends of mine who are you know, alleged staunch atheists, oftentimes they are arguing against what I perceive to be a caricature of God or of religion. And I thought, and I look at him, I say, I don't believe in that version of God either. You know, so.
But how do we tell you have to?
Right. I'm like, no, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the strangest thing. I say, okay, you don't believe in God. Tell me about this God you don't believe in. Well, I don't believe in that God either. Well, then you're not a Christian. Yes, I am. No, you don't. Well, hold right. on here.
Yeah. So how do we
atheist gets to tell me I'm not a Christian because I don't believe what they don't believe? I don't know.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, how do we change the conversation in such a way that says, like, look, no, I take this just as seriously as you do. You know, and you brought up the early church fathers earlier, and that's I think a prime example of where we can go back in our church history and say, here are some early Christians who thought you know, and believed slightly different things than perhaps this kind of, again, Western sort of
right.
version of Christianity. And they were still considered Christians. So, you know, so how do we change kind of the conversation around
Christianity
this kind of
is
dualistic?
Modern. Christianity is pre-modern. And so the question then becomes, can a pre-modern faith live in a modern world? I say yes. Others have said, no, we have to accommodate Christianity to this age, and we have to make it modern. I think that's what we're seeing the end of. I think that's the Christianity that finally is going to die, that it has been ripped out of its natural habitat, forced to try to capitulate to the terms of modernity and empiricism, and it just eventually it won't live. But then what I want to alert people to is that that was never the soil it was rooted in to begin with anyway. The historic faith is not rooted in that kind of soil. It's something much older. We don't read the Bible as a journalist or as a scientist. I mean, you can do textual criticism. I get that. And I like it. And I've read those books. I understand that. But that's not what's going to feed your soul. I mean, you can do it. I mean, you know, there's value to knowing, okay, there's Deuter Isaiah. You know, there's Second Isaiah, that there's Isaiah of Jerusalem. But then 150 years later, there's Isaiah of the Exile. You can see this in the text. I get all that. And I like it. That's cool. But I don't want to read my Bible forever like that. Okay, now I know that. But can I go back to a more ancient way of reading the Scripture where actually we are expecting there to be inspiration? And we expect somehow to see something fresh and new for the text to speak to us. You know, Lecto Divina. Now, interestingly, this is how many Pentecostals and Charismatics read the Bible. I've never have understood how it is that Charismatics and Pentecostals got underneath the evangelical tent, because they're not evangelicals. They're a different breed. I think it's the culture wars that put everybody under that same tent. But I would like to see Charismatics and Pentecostals actually going back to being a little more charismatic and Pentecostal. And not necessarily feeling like they have to toe the line of fundamentalist biblicists. I'm all over the road here, but for example, Pentecostals and Charismatics are just intuitively sacramental. And, you know, modern fundamentalist evangelicalism is almost totally non-sacramental. This is not a portal to another world. It's just a sign. It's just a memory. It's just a reminder. It's just a memorial. We'll try to tell a Pentecostal that the laying on of hands is just symbolic. Say, oh, no, there's something to this.
Right. Yeah.
But being sacrament is pre-modern. It's within modernity that we end up trying to explain sacraments in an empiricist way, and then the project collapses, and everything just has to become a symbol or a memorial. I think we should read. So I would like Pentecostals and Charismatics to return to their roots, and then understand that their roots are actually rooted in the sacramental world of the early church.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think. One of the things that I really enjoyed about kind of towards the end of your book too, because I know we're I want to squeeze a couple more things in here, Adia. So the grace of second naivete, mm-hmm. I thought that was a fascinating chapter. This kind of a return to innocence. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this is a term that comes from Paul Ricoeur, French philosopher, and he's talking about getting beyond the critical reading of the text. Maybe instead of talking about it in philosophical terms, I should talk about just my own experience. And so I had a dramatic encounter with Christ as a teenager. Overnight, I went from being the high school Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak. It surprised everybody, including me, but it happened. It's not something that I can prove. I can say that Christ was revealed to me to be the Son of God. I can't prove that claim, and it can't be disproven. I can bear witness to it, and it can be believed or disbelieved. But immediately upon that encounter, I began to read the Bible. And I read the Bible a lot, I mean a whole lot, and I read it very simply. I read it kind of on a When I say a literal level, I wasn't a complete literalist. I always knew that there was going to be symbol and allegory, but I still pretty much read it literally. And it didn't create any problem. And if people can read the Bible literally and it's not a problem, I'm not here to talk them out of it. But usually people that, you know, if you're living in this modern world and you're watching a PBS documentary now and then, you know, eventually you might get some questions. And so then you go on the project of learning how to read the Bible critically again, or for the first time, how to read it critically. And so, you know, how did the Old Testament, the Torah, come to be? And then you get your JEDP, you get your, you know, documentary hypothesis. And I began to read all of that sort of stuff. And by the way, I loved every moment of it. I find it fascinating. That you have the Yahwehists and the Elohimists and the Deuteronomists and the Priestly, and they're all, and that's why you have two creation stories.
Right, yeah.
But then when you get to the Noah story, for whatever reason, whoever's behind all of this, you know, probably during the Babylonian exile, they didn't want to have two Noah stories, two flood stories, so they put them into one, which is why it's confusing and reads so awkwardly. You could just do this on your own. Just look for Lord in all caps, L-O-R-D. That's, you know, Yahweh. And then as opposed to God, this is in your English translation, Elohim. And just pull those two apart. And when it's talking about Yahweh, read that story. And when it's talking about Elohim or God, read it that way. And you have two stories that don't perfectly agree, but each story is more coherent that way. Well, I mean, I started learning all that stuff, and I like it. It appealed to me. It didn't ever threaten my faith. I thought, well, that's really cool. But then finally, you know, after 20 years of reading all of that stuff, and I did, I mean, I read it all. I've reached the point where I feel like I've come through to a second naivete. A return to a more childlike reading. So I read the story of the parting of the Red Sea and Israel coming through the waters and the Egyptians being drowned. There's enough background in higher criticism and other forms of theology that I'm no longer troubled. Did that literally happen? Can we find rusting chariots below the Red Sea somewhere if we just get the right scuba gear and submarines? I don't have to deal with trouble about, you know, well, we seem to have a violent image of this God of the Old Testament that will command genocide and kill off entire armies in one fell swoop. And that's where, no, that lurks in the background. I can actually draw upon that anytime I want. I can draw upon that knowledge. But that's not how I'm reading the Bible today. I need to hear the stories about a God who delivers an oppressed people and brings them through when there's no way. And about giants that can be slain by little boys with slingshots and walls that can just crumble because people prayed and praised. And I need those stories to feed my faith and not have to always read them as if I have to be reading in the academy. I want to be able to read as we were intended to read in church and to read a story that is given to us to inspire faith in the living God and to evoke the idea that this God can be present in our lives in all kinds of surprising ways. And so I think my deconstruction, I'll go back to that word. My deconstruction was, in one sense, very radical. I mean, I've been more than one person in my life, it seems like, you know. I mean, the Brian Zond, who was the pastor of Word Alive Church, let's say 1996. And the Brian Zond, I mean, if you do a DNA analysis, you'll find it's the same guy. But it's not the same guy. I mean, I've been born again, and I've been born again and again. I've been born again and again and again. It's just part of it. So I'm a very different person. And in one sense, you could embarrass me. You know, you pull up some, I mean, they exist somewhere. There's all those cassette tapes. You can find me preaching nonsense, you know, things that I would cringe at today. But in one sense, I don't want to be embarrassed. I want to say, well, you know, that was my journey. I don't know from where I started to where I am today. I don't know how I get here without going through some of that. Maybe you do. I don't. And so I really don't want to be embarrassed. There's enough distance now. I can look upon my 35-year-old self and have mercy on him and just say, he just needs some more time. It's okay. He just needs some more time. You know, he's not done yet. This is a long pilgrimage. He just started, or he's halfway or whatever. And so, there is a way of once again returning to, because I'll hear people say, you know, I no longer believe in an interventionist God. Well, look, I mean, I teach a prayer school, and the thing that I say the most in prayer school is that the primary purpose of prayer is not to get God to do what we think God ought to do, but to be properly formed. That being said, I think God is constantly intervening in our lives. And to say, I no longer believe in an interventionist God, I think is just really trying to buffer yourself from any possibility of disappointment. That we now pray such safe prayers that first of all, we would never know if they were answered or not, because we're not even asking anything, really. I think people can bear disappointment. I think what we can't bear is the idea that God is absent. I mean, a non-interventionist God, I mean, we're just back to deism. I mean, you've just, to me, you sound like you're Thomas Jefferson, you know, in the 18th century. You know, the remote guy that, you know, built the clock and then ran off and let the thing run. No, I think God's love isn't, it may not be, it's not something we can manipulate. It's not something we can write a how-to book, how to get God to do what you think God ought to do. That's gone. But does God respond in some way to the aspiration of prayer and to me seeking to love other people by praying for them? I think those create all kinds of pathways for grace to come into their lives and our lives. So I've read the Bible literally. I've read it analytically. And now today, I guess I want to read it mystically. I don't know if I say that in the book or not, but that's good. I should say that.
I love that.
Literally and then analytically, and now I want to read it mystically.
Oh, that might be in contention for the quote at the beginning now. So, so one last question. I want to leave our listeners with this. So, when everything's on fire, faith forged from the ashes, what is your hope for this book to do for folks who read it?
Well, it's a pretty. I mean, I got a couple of hopes. I hope that for some, faith will be seen beautiful and credible. But my biggest hope, and this is an outlandish hope, but I think I hope that there are some out there that can help preserve Christian faith in their life, that they might be in the possibility of being done, and this becomes a lifeline to hold on and maybe find their way to what I've found. I mean, I'm not just writing at a distant objectivity. I'm writing really in one way from my own experience that if you have any inkling of a hope that there is the possibility of a better Christianity, I want to say that hope is well-founded. There is. And that's a big hope, but I hope that the book can help people move in that direction.
Well, I, having read it, gotten a sneak peek at the book, because I believe it comes out in November. Is that
November 9th? Yes.
November 9th. So this episode will come out right around then. And I truly hope that people go get it. I think it's an absolutely fantastic book. I've of course been a fan of yours for a long time. So once again, appreciate you coming back on the show and spending some time with us.
John, thank you very much. It's a delight to talk with you.
He constructed these walls and I found a business where the company line was the only way to get paid. We better anything against it. Where the refugee suffers and the white man has it made. I won't do it anymore. It's taken me too long. Try to help the world to recover. I sat myself in your pews every single week, and I gave you my money so that you would tell me what to.
Know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.